CBS News Face the Nation in 60 seconds.
Are you hiring but not sure where to find the best candidates? As a business owner, I can tell you that your company is only as good as the people you hire. I can also tell you that posting your job in one place isn't enough to find quality candidates. But when you're short-staffed, there's no time to deal with the dozens of different job sites. Until now. Thanks to ZipRecruiter.com, I can post to 100-plus job sites with one single click and have the highest possible chance of finding that perfect candidate. Just post once, and within 24 hours, watch your candidates roll in to ZipRecruiter's easy-to-use interface. ZipRecruiter has been used by over 300,000 businesses, and you can try it right now for free. Getting the right people for your company is so important. Try ZipRecruiter and get your perfect candidate before they go to somebody else. Today, you can try ZipRecruiter for free. Go to ZipRecruiter.com/deal. That's ZipRecruiter.com/deal. Again, ZipRecruiter.com/deal.
Today on Face the Nation, the parade of Republican presidential candidates rolls on. U.S. forces stage a daring raid in Syria against ISIS, and the mystery of the Amtrak derailment in Philadelphia. Amtrak is ordered to make safety changes to the Northeast Corridor rails. We'll get the latest on the train accident that killed 8 outside of Philadelphia from the head NTSB investigator Bob Sumwalt and Pennsylvania Senator Bob Casey. Plus another gab fest of 2016 Republican candidates in Iowa.
In less than 2 years, we're going to have a Republican president in the White House.
I talked with former Secretary of Defense Robert Gates and asked him what he thinks of the would-be president so far.
Most of these candidates have no experience in foreign policy.
And we'll talk to one of them, Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker. Then we'll get the latest on that U.S. attack against ISIS from the new chairman of the House Intelligence Committee, Devin Nunes. It's all ahead because this is Face the Nation. Good morning. First, the train. Investigators say they've asked the FBI to investigate the possibility of a projectile hitting Amtrak 188 just before it derailed Tuesday night. So we begin with Robert Sumwalt, who's a member of the National Transportation Safety Board, the point man on this investigation. Is it possible that this thing that hit the train windshield that we now know about, is it possible somebody shot at that train?
Bob, we're certainly going to be looking at that. As you pointed out, we're going to have the FBI providing their technical assistance to help us analyze exactly what sort of fracture pattern may be on that windshield.
Well, is there any way that that could have been connected to the crash in some way?
And you know, that's a great point. It could be completely coincidental or it could be causal, and that's exactly what we intend to find out.
But it could have been somebody fired a shot at the train.
You know, I'd like to downplay that part of it. I've seen the fracture pattern. It looks like something about the size of a grapefruit, if you will, and it did not even penetrate the entire windshield.
Well, what is it? I mean, that could have if there was a connection, what could it have been? That it distracted the engineer or something of that sort?
And certainly everything is on the table in that respect. We're really looking at everything, and this is just another piece of the investigation.
Well, the engineer says he has no memory of anything. Does that make sense to you?
It certainly does. As we know, people can be in an automobile crash and they'll say, I don't even remember the crash. I just woke up in the hospital. And so that's typical in some traumatic event like this.
Well, was he actually injured?
Yes, sir. He was injured.
And was it a head injury?
The media sources are reporting that he had a concussion and had staples. So that's what the media reports are.
But as the investigator, you don't know?
Well, I do, but of course there's HIPAA regulations that would prohibit even me from releasing those sorts of information. So I'll just tell you what the media sources are. But yes, he did spend some time in the hospital.
And you're satisfied that he's cooperating now?
Yes, sir. We met with him on Friday, and he was very cooperative and provided us with information of what he did know.
Do you think that this in any way is connected with Amtrak being underfunded?
Well, we're certainly not going to get at that at the NTSB, getting into that political fray, but we will say that we have long called for positive train control, and we believe that positive train control, if installed and operational, it would have prevented this accident.
Well, why wasn't it?
Well, that's a question that we intend to find out. Of course, it's not required to be installed by the end of the year, but we do want to know what the management decisions were at Amtrak, which those decisions were to install positive train control in certain parts of that track, but not in others.
All right. Well, Mr. Investigator, we want to thank you for joining us this morning. We're going to go now to Senator Bob Casey. He's at the 30th Street Station in Philadelphia. He rides this train twice a week. Do you think, Senator, that something should have been done that wasn't done, and that's why we had this accident, or was it just simply this train was speeding?
Well, Bob, I think we've got to wait for the results of the investigation to be certain, but the little information we do know about speed and about the nature of the curve and the basic facts that are on the record right now, I think indicate that we've got to make sure that as Mr. Sumwalt just said, that we have positive train control in place. So if you're a member of Congress, as I am, and the law says, as it does, that by the end of the year, positive train control has to be implemented and deployed, we have to make sure that we do everything possible to support Amtrak in completing that assignment.
Well, we're committed to it. To those who may not know, what is positive train control? What does that mean?
It's a good question. It's a technology that allows the train engineer, if he or she is not slowing the train down appropriately, it can override that human error if the train's moving too fast. It's among other things sensors and technology that allows that train to slow down when it should and to comply with the speed regulations, in addition to sensing other problems on the track. So it's remarkably effective technology. We got to make sure that it's on
Do you think Amtrak has done enough to ensure passenger safety, or are there things that need to be done here?
Well, I think an incident like this causes us to question a lot of things once we have the facts. And as you know, NTSB will be providing more facts in a preliminary report, and then down the road, maybe as long as a year, a full-scale report. We have to make sure that the Congress reacts appropriately to that. The Congress should not put Amtrak in the position of choosing between positive train control safety and fixing crumbling bridges. We have to do both, and we've got to make sure they have the resources to do that. We don't know the connection between funding and this incident, but regardless, Amtrak needs more funding. I've been advocating for years, and at a minimum, I think we should fund what the president proposed as opposed to what was done the other day in the House Appropriations Committee.
Do you think there will be a congressional investigation, or will you let it go with this NTSB investigation?
I would guess that the Congress, in its oversight role, would have some sort of investigation beyond the routine appropriations debates. But that's really up to the relevant committees in House and Senate.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Senator. Thank you.
Thanks, Bob.
We turn now to campaign 2016, and with foreign policy on the front burner again, we sought out Robert Gates, Secretary of Defense for both President George W. Bush and President Obama. We asked him what he thought of the candidates so far on foreign policy.
I haven't been particularly impressed, frankly, by anybody at this point on either side of the aisle. I'm not seeing much courage when it comes to support of the trade agreements, which are, I think, very important for this country. I think the president's right on that. I think that there's an awful lot of easy solutions to tough problems that are being bruited about. So I think we have to wait. Most of these candidates have no experience in foreign policy. In fact, very few do on the Republican side have any experience, or very little, maybe 2 or 3 years in the Senate. But perhaps their views will be fleshed out and become more cogent as the campaign goes along. But so far, they're in early days, and I think their views are probably largely unformed.
You work for how many presidents?
Eight.
Eight presidents. You work for both Bushes. Jeb Bush is off to kind of a stumbling start, it seems to me. Obviously, he has great fundraising potential here, but over the last week, he's had trouble answering the question about would he have gone into Iraq knowing what he now knows. First, he said, yes, he would. Then he said, well, it's a hypothetical question. Then he said, well, actually, no, he wouldn't. You have any advice for him?
That's one question where I would have thought he would have had an answer figured out before he got into the middle of this. It was an inevitable question that would be asked, and I think that the way to deal with it, frankly, is to say you don't make policy by going back and reliving old decisions. One of the things that I admired about both President Bush and second President Bush and President Obama was they didn't have second thoughts. They made a decision and they moved on. And and I think, you know, the same thing as a candidate. You just say what you believe and then you move on.
We will have more from Bob Gates later, including his take on Hillary Clinton. But now to Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker, one of the Republicans exploring a run in 2016. He's in Iowa this morning. Governor, welcome. Well, you just heard Secretary Gates, not exactly complimentary to the Republican field thus far, but does he have a point?
Well, I think foreign policy is going to be an important part, along with talking about growth, helping grow the economy, and helping reform the federal government by taking power from Washington and sending it back to the states. But I talk to people all the time. I was just in La Crosse, Wisconsin yesterday at my state party convention, last night at the Iowa Republican Party event. And I got to tell you, one of the areas where people talk the most to me about is the safety and security of this country and our allies around the world. So I do think it's going to be an important issue. If I choose to get into this race, it's something I'm going to lay out a very clear plan for what we should do going forward and how we should address the issues we face here in America and the issues we face around the world. So I think there's a wide open door to lay out a very clear doctrine. And I do think that if foreign policy plays an important role, the contrast will be clear because everywhere, just about everywhere that Hillary Clinton has played a role with this president under President Obama, that part of the world is largely a failure, a mess, because of the policies that we've seen from Obama and Clinton.
Well, you've just come back from Israel, but let me just ask you, what would you list as your foreign policy credentials?
Well, I think as a governor, it's really ultimately about leadership. To me, in my lifetime, one of the best presidents when it comes to foreign policy was a governor from California. In my lifetime, one of the worst presidents when it comes to foreign policy was a freshman senator from Illinois. So I think it's not just about past experiences. It's about leadership. As a governor, you have to put a cabinet in place, and hopefully you pick people as smarter than you on any given topic. I think that's something that's required of a successful president, is putting people in place, be it Secretary of Defense, National Security Advisor, Secretary of State, and others, and then having the good sense to listen to them and to others and the chain of command and the military, consulting with the Congress. All those sorts of things I think are important of a president, and I think successful governors in either party have to do that every single day, consult with people in their cabinet and act. Now, the most beyond that is, as a governor, I've been to just recently in Germany and Spain and France. Earlier in the year was the United Kingdom on trade-related missions, a few years back in China and Japan. So that's probably the most that any governor of either party has, is that experience in terms of trade relations, and something I think is very important, not just to our states, it's important to our country.
Well, you know, Jeb Bush, and you just heard what Secretary Gates said, he was a governor, but he had kind of a hard time, it seems to me, answering that question of would he have gone into Iraq had he known what we all now know. And he gave about four different answers. By the end of the week, he said, well, no, he wouldn't have. What do you have to say about that? Did that surprise you?
I didn't agree with what... I tend to agree with Secretary Gates. We should really be talking about the challenges we face going forward. But I did stand up and defend the president, President Bush, that is, saying I think any president, regardless of party, probably would have made a similar decision to what President Bush did at the time with the information he had available. Remember, even Secretary of State, then Senator Clinton, voted for measures supporting the Iraq war. I think it was a failure in many cases in the intelligence that was given to the president, to the Congress at the time. Knowing what we know now, I think it's safe for many of us, myself included, to say we probably wouldn't have taken that tack. But I give credit to the president for recognizing the challenges, for being responsible for the surge, listening to those in Congress who were pushing for that. That was highly successful. And I also think it's important to learn from the fact that this president and the advisors he had, like Secretary Clinton, I think made a mistake by urging the country to pull back from our stand in Iraq, and we have a place that's largely destabilized now because of their quick move in the last few years to get out of Iraq. That's something we need to learn from going forward. We have a very destabilized region, and we need to have a strong presence there.
Let me ask you about something that you said previously. You told a gathering that the most significant foreign policy decision of your lifetime was Ronald Reagan's ending of the 1981 air traffic controller strike. You said it sent a message not only across America, it sent a message around the world. Don't you think there may have been a few things, while I agree that that was a significant development, a few things maybe a little more important, like the Nixon's opening to China, for example, the decision to go after Osama bin Laden? Do you really think that was the most significant foreign policy statement of your lifetime?
Well, I think those were all important things. Don't get me wrong in that regard. But this is not something I hold alone. Former Secretary of State George Shultz said that that was the most significant action during the Reagan administration. I came of age during the Reagan administration. I was, I believe, just turned 13 2 days before his election in 1980. And for me, looking at that kind of leadership, he set the tone, not just domestically with that action. He sent the message around the world, as you just read off, I think not only to our allies, that this was someone who was serious that could be trusted, but in combination with our adversaries, they sent a clear message not to mess with him. You'd combine that clear leadership position he took early in his administration with the buildup in the military, much like we need today to get back to a minimum, at least a Gates-level budget for the Department of Defense. You combine that and what he did in the 80s with the leadership he showed early on in his term, and that's why I believe in many regards we had one of the lowest levels of military engagement. Not because the President Reagan was afraid to engage, but because our adversaries knew he would if needed. And I think that made for a safer world. That was peace through strength personified.
Let me ask you quickly about the Iran negotiations. You're ready to stop the negotiations, as I understand it. What do you see as the alternative?
Well, I think if we're going to have negotiations, we should have them on our terms, not on theirs. To me, we need to dismantle the illicit nuclear infrastructure they have. That has to be clear. It's a real threat, not just to Israel. I've talked to leaders from the Persian Gulf states, the Sunni states, who have very real concerns in that regard. Secondly, they need to provide full disclosure, transparency, and immediate ability to inspect, which I don't think we fully have right now under at least the parameters of the supposed deal. And third, we need to make sure that they deal with others in the region. That Iran, in many ways, is not much different than the country. I remember as a kid when I tied yellow ribbons around the tree in front of our house when Americans were held hostage. People like my friend Kevin Hermening from Wausau, Wisconsin, who was the youngest Marine held there. I don't see a lot changing. They need to learn to deal with others in the region. I think you've seen their influence in terms of Shiite militias, not only in Iraq, but obviously their involvement in Syria, now with the Houthis in Yemen. Those are the sorts of things we need to crack down on.
All right. And one final question. When are you going to make the decision on whether or not to run?
My state budget will be completed by the end of June. It's something I'm focused on every day, completing another budget with a fifth and sixth year of property tax relief on. Once that's completed at the end of June, we'll announce our intentions to our state, to our country, and the world, and we'll keep you posted.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Governor. Nice to talk to you.
Great to be with you, too.
And we'll be back in 1 minute. And we're back now with the new chairman of the House Intelligence Committee, California Republican Devin Nunes. He joins us for his first Sunday show interview since becoming chairman. We want to welcome you, Mr. Chairman. Let's just talk a little bit about this raid that took place over the weekend. U.S. Special Forces went into Syria, apparently killed a fairly significant ISIS leader, got out without any Americans being killed. Flesh it out for us. What do you know?
Well, many of us have been advocating this strategy for a long time, or using this tactic, because it's just a better way to gather intelligence versus just airstrikes. So it takes guts for the administration and our military to put a action like this together. It was successful. We're happy that they got back and got back safely. Now, over the coming weeks, we'll know what they were actually able to gather there.
What do you? I hear they may have gotten computers, phones. How significant would that
be? Well, this target was known as the accountant for ISIS. So hopefully, one would assume there would be a lot of intelligence at his hideout.
He was the one, as I understand it, who was brokering sales of oil.
And so you would want to know what he's doing, because you would want to know how they're bringing in money, moving money, and then spreading it out to the organization.
You are just coming to the chairmanship of this committee. What's your first impression? How are we doing in this fight against ISIS?
Well, I think it's important for people to know, first off, that ISIS I describe as Al-Qaeda 6.0, which is what Ambassador Crocker defined ISIS as. So this is really the sixth generation of Al-Qaeda. The problem that we have now, I think the American people need to understand, and the administration needs to get a better grasp of, is ISIS is not in just Iraq and Syria. So if you want to, if your strategy is to degrade and ultimately defeat ISIS, and you're not looking at the broader picture of places like North Africa, Libya, essentially what you have is a containment strategy, not an effort to degrade and defeat ISIS. And I say that because you have many of the fighters we know are coming from North Africa. And if you don't stop that flow of fighters, plus the flow of fighters from the West that are coming down in through Turkey, getting trained and then coming out to the West, you're going to have an ever-increasing terrorist threat for the United States and our allies.
Well, do you feel we're making progress here, or are we losing?
I think we are containing ISIS within the borders of Iraq and Syria. Outside of that, we're not doing much.
On Wednesday, you sent a letter to the president warning that the five Taliban who were released from Gitmo as a prisoner exchange for a boy, Bergdahl, last summer, are due to be released from confinement in Qatar. Are you concerned about that?
Yeah, so what we explained to the president was on June 1st, so we're less than 2 weeks away from guys who we know. And what I said in the letter is we know they are in communications with bad guys, just like they were doing before when they were picked up on the battlefield and brought to Guantanamo in the first place. So many of us believe they never should have been released. And we just sent a letter to the president to make sure that you work with the Qataris. We don't want these five guys going back to the battlefield, engineering plans to kill American and NATO and our NATO allies.
Well, what do you know about them?
We know that they've been back once they got to Qatar, that they have had been in constant communication with some of their old pals.
What about this whole issue of Guantanamo? Do you think it ought to be closed down?
No, I've long been on the record saying that we need to leave Guantanamo open. I think one of the tragedies is that we've been relying more on drone strikes, which is a very effective tool, don't get me wrong, and we need to have it in our arsenal. But when you go out and you vaporize our opponents, it makes it, and you're not willing to bring them to places like Guantanamo and get actionable intelligence from them, it makes it harder to understand the enemy, thus harder to defeat the enemy.
The big thing in Congress right now, the trade agreement that's pending, where do you come down on that?
Look, I believe it is imperative for us, for our national security interests, to quickly pass trade promotion authority, because you can then move on to the Trans-Pacific Partnership and an agreement with our European allies. If you can bring those trade agreements together, you will have two-thirds of the world's economy under the same trade agreement, which allows for fair and free trade, unlike what we have now.
All right. Mr. Chairman, it's certainly nice to have you. We hope you'll come back many times. And we'll be right back.
Face the Nation after this short break.
The day I realized that the business I dreamt of starting had actually become a reality was the day I saw my first business card. And I created it in a matter of minutes at Vistaprint.com. Vistaprint really puts you in control and makes it simple to create customized business cards for every kind of business. I'll never forget seeing that card and thinking, this is it. I did it.
Right now, you can get 500 standard business cards from Vistaprint for just $9.99. Just go to Vistaprint.com today and enter promo code 6969 at checkout. That's Vistaprint.com, promo code 6969.
Maybe you saw this. Even so, you need to see it again. Mitt Romney fought a boxing match with heavyweight champion Evander Holyfield. I'm serious. Look. Here he is entering the arena in Salt Lake City, and yes, that's Mrs. Romney wearing the Batman hat leading the way. Once in the ring, they stripped him of his robe and the usual shirt and tie, and the announcer announced his record.
His political career record, one win and one very big loss.
And then the fight began. Actually, there was more dancing than fighting, but Romney did manage to get in a few jams. Holyfield may or may not have realized he'd been hit, but he did remain upright.
Romney threw in the towel during the second round. It was all for charity. And he put his shirt on and took a few political jabs, saying if people wondered who could have negotiated such a mismatch, it was obvious.
The answer is John Kerry, of course. And
I'm not sure about Romney's future as a boxer, but when a guy in my age demographic takes his shirt off in public and the ladies don't go, ew, I gotta say he gets a high five from me. So here you go, Governor.
Face the nation after this short break.
With CudaSign, paperless e-signing is a no-brainer for any business that requires legally binding signatures fast. That's because CudaSign offers everything you should expect from an electronic signature solution for just $1 per month. CudaSign cuts document turnaround time as much as 90%, thanks in part to its number one rated mobile app. And CudaSign's secure cloud stores documents for on-demand tracking and retrieval, saving you even more time and money. Don't think twice. Get CudaSign now for just $1 per month. Go to CudaSign.com.
Welcome back to Face the Nation. We spoke Friday to former Secretary of Defense Bob Gates at the College of William and Mary in Williamsburg, Virginia, where he is chancellor. Secretary Gates' best-selling book, Duty, Memoirs of a Secretary at War, is now out in paperback. And we ask, among other things, what he thought about the nuclear deal with Iran.
Well, first of all, getting the Iranians to the negotiating table in the first place was a success for U.S. foreign policy. They didn't come to the table out of goodwill. They came to the table because their economy was being strangled and the leadership was afraid they might get overthrown. So they're there because they have to be there. I think that the agreement, there's some specifics in the agreement that are very encouraging, but I have several concerns that I hope can be addressed in the negotiations between now and June. The first is the timing of the lifting of the sanctions. Are they going to be lifted right away? As long as the Iranians agree to implement the agreement? Or will they be phased over time based on performance, which has been our position all along? The second is verification. Unless we have sort of on-demand inspection at all facilities, including military facilities, I think there's a great potential to cheat. Third, I think that the idea of being able to have these snapback sanctions, that sanctions could be reimposed once lifted, is very unrealistic. I think that the pursuit of the agreement is based on the president's hope that over a 10-year period with the sanctions being lifted, that the Iranians will become a constructive stakeholder in the international community, that as their economy begins to grow again, that they will abandon their ideology, their theology, their revolutionary principles, their meddling in various parts of the region. And frankly, I believe that's very unrealistic.
What if we can't get a deal? What is the alternative?
Well, I don't think the alternative is war. One alternative is a better deal. I think that you go back to the sanctions. I think you reinforce the sanctions. And you basically say, here are the additional things we need for this agreement to work and to be worthwhile. And an agreement that reassures our allies, or at least doesn't scare them half to death. If they choose not to come back to the negotiations, but to race to a nuclear weapon, well, my guess is that'll show that they intended to do that all along, despite all their protestations that they have no interest in a nuclear weapon. But I think that there is a potential for a better deal.
You worked very closely with Hillary Clinton when she was Secretary of State. You two kind of bonded, it seemed to me, during the administration. You think she's qualified to be president?
Well, I only ever dealt with Secretary Clinton on foreign policy matters, and as I wrote in my book, we never discussed domestic affairs, and that probably was a good thing. But I think that she was a good Secretary of State. I think she played a critical role and getting the much tougher sanctions on Iran and getting particularly the Russians and the Chinese on board to allow those more severe sanctions to be put into place. We agreed in terms of the Afghan surge. If anything, she was tougher than I was on that. She was ready to support McChrystal's 40,000 request for 40,000 troops and only went along with the 30,000 because I proposed it. I think that we certainly agreed in terms of how to deal with the very first phases of the Arab Spring, and particularly disagreeing with the president on how to handle Mubarak. So the first place we actually ever parted ways was on the intervention in Libya, which she supported and I opposed.
Does it bother you, this controversy that's sprung up around her about having her own server on the emails and deleting emails and all of that business?
Well, I think it's a concern. I never used email for official business when I was either, well, when I was director of CIA, email was still in its infancy. but as Secretary of Defense, I mean, I would use it for personal things, but I never used email for business. And I just think it's a risky way to try and do business.
And what about this controversy now over foreign governments contributing to the Clinton Foundation? And this went on while she was Secretary of State.
Well, I don't know the details. I really only know what I've read in the press and so on. But it, I mean, the question is, did the foundation abide by the agreements that were made when Secretary Clinton became secretary, the agreements that were made with President Obama and his staff, or the president-elect and his staff? Were those agreements fulfilled? I think that's the key question. And it is an issue of appearances, at a minimum.
If it came down to it, could you see yourself voting for Hillary Clinton?
Well, I think it's a little early to start throwing that away. And besides, I'm not sure that having a Republican endorse you is the best thing at this point.
The big argument in Washington right now is over the trade bill. And here we have Republicans, a lot of them lining up with the president on this, and some in his own party are the most vehement critics of this bill. Where do you come out on all
that? I'm totally supportive of these trade pacts. I think that the president is exactly right. He needs this fast-track authority. This is important for not only our economic relationships with other countries and our own economic growth long-term, it's important in terms of our political relationships and our security relationships with other countries, particularly in Asia. So I think that this is it's profoundly mistaken to oppose these trade pacts, and particularly in the way they've been put forward.
We're now hearing in Iraq new victories by ISIS. Can you envision the United States having to send ground troops back into there?
Actually, I think sending large numbers of U.S. ground troops back into Iraq would be a serious mistake. But I do believe that the rules of engagement for our troops need to be more flexible. I think we need to have more deeply embedded trainers with the Iraqi Kurdish, the Iraqi security forces, the Sunni tribes with the Kurds in the north. I think we need to have forward air controllers and spotters. We need to have special forces in there. I think to be able to really get at ISIS, we need, and these are relatively small numbers. We have 3,000 plus in country already. It seems to me a fraction of those, if given broader rules of engagement, could play a more effective role. I worry about the role of the Iranians and the Shia militias in Iraq. And so for us to be more deeply engaged, but we're talking hundreds or maybe at most 1,000 U.S. forces, sending a big U.S. force back in would be a mistake, and I don't know of anybody who really supports that.
You're still concerned by the dysfunction in Washington. Do you see a way out of that?
It really is simply a matter of leadership. I mean, there are a lot of structural changes that have taken place over the last 30 years or so we've always had tough politics in this country. We've always had polarized politics. But my favorite example is the politics today are no worse than they were when the Republicans controlled both houses of Congress in 1947. And Truman was a hated president. And he still got the NATO agreement, he got the NATO treaty approved, he restructured the national security organizations. He got the Marshall Plan through. People were still willing to reach across the aisle to do what was in the best interest of the country. And I think what's missing now are that band in the middle, both center-left and center-right, who are willing to reach across and do deals and get things done. And anybody who wants to compromise is accused of selling out or betraying their principles. And that's not the way our system of government works. The Constitution is a bundle of compromises. The only way divided government, meaning the three separate branches of government, works is through compromise. And you get these people, men and women back there, who basically say, it's my way or the highway. That's not the way the American system has ever been able to work.
Secretary, it's always fun to talk to you, and wish you the best.
Thanks a lot, Bob. Wish you the best, too.
Thank you.
Back now for some analysis with some of my favorite people. Peggy Noonan, who is a columnist for the Wall Street Journal and a CBS News contributor. David Ignatius is a Washington Post columnist. And in New York this morning, New York Magazine columnist Frank Rich. So Peggy, let me just start with you. This is a tough week for Jeb Bush.
Yeah, it definitely was. He seemed consistently taken aback by the asking of a question anyone could have told you a year and 2 years ago was going to be a primary question of the primary time. It was difficult for him in ways that are almost mysterious. And because I think he showed such discomfort in his answers, he sort of opened up the possibility that this will only be the beginning of many questions about things your brother did. Would you have done them? Do you know what I mean? So it was difficult. However, he deserves, I think, great credit in this. He's going to the press every day. He's taking questions. He's being out there. He's doing sit-down interviews. Mrs. Clinton instead is doing sort of a silent movie of a campaign in which she doesn't feel she has to do those things. I don't think that's a good way to go, and will be problematic for her down the road.
Well, what do you think, David? I would guess that at some point here, Hillary Clinton is going to have a news conference.
She is, I wrote this week, playing a rope-a-dope campaign to remember Muhammad Ali, the fighter, presumably hoping to let Republicans punch themselves out, swinging and swinging, and by the time we get to the real campaign, their arms will be tired. I'm not sure that's going to work. I found it genuinely troubling that on an issue where she was involved in the takeoff, the Trans-Pacific Partnership trade deal, she has been so silent, as if she's really running scared from the liberal wing of her own party and not putting her views out there. I thought the president, by contrast, was really a strong voice for what he believes in. And I think for Clinton to be compelling, she's going to have that same full-throated expression of what she thinks.
What do you think, Frank Rich? A lot of focus on foreign policy so far in this campaign. Do you think that is going to go right on into when we get into the final years of the campaign season? They seem to last for a couple of years now.
Yeah, the final decade, it feels like already. Right. I feel, look, if we're at war, which we're unlikely to be, and I hope we won't be, of course it would be an enormous issue. But short of that, I'm not sure. I also feel if Republicans want to distinguish themselves from Hillary Clinton, it's probably not a good way to do it. She is the most hawkish national Democrat can be. She was Secretary of State, which is a credential they don't have. Even if you think she wasn't a great Secretary of State, it's hard to take that away from her. She is the red phone at 3 o'clock in the morning candidate. And you have a bunch of fresh-faced, youngish Republicans, for the most part, who look like neophytes. And no matter how hawkish they are, they all sort of sound the same. They're going to have to put themselves far to the right in sort of neocon territory to distinguish themselves from her. The one exception, Rand Paul, has already sort of cratered on his revolt in Republican foreign policy. So I don't see even the percentage for Republicans, and I think the public as a whole much more interested in domestic issues, particularly as always the economy.
Well, Peggy, let's go back and talk a little bit about this Republican field. There are several dozen of them, but as you heard Bob Gates say earlier today, and he is basically a Republican, although he has worked for eight presidents. He said he's not impressed with any of them so far.
Yeah, he has a way the past few years of exhibiting a fabulous and dangerous candor, Mr. Gates, and it's a kind of a delight to see. I think there's one little distinction to be made here. He looks at the Republican field and in terms of foreign policy, he says, well, I see pretty thin experience or knowledge, more or less. There's a distinction between the Republican governors going forward for the presidency and the Republican senators. The Republican senators are more immersed and have been more immersed. Their brain space has been filled more with foreign policy. The governors are mostly young men who are, in effect, catching up. Their brain space the past 8 years has been full of domestic issues and sewer contracts and how the state is doing in terms of its economic environment. I do think, however, that the 2016 election will be both an economic and a foreign policy election. It's a great cliche of American politics that every presidential is about the economy. This one, I think, will be half economy and half foreign policy because we all sense that the world is exploding every day. So it will be important, and there are Republicans who I think have some distance to go to make up for some gaps.
Well, David, my sense of it is that no job, being a senator, being a governor, being a business executive, prepares one for being president of the United States.
I think that's absolutely right. We referred earlier in the broadcast to Harry Truman, in one sense, utterly unprepared to become president after Franklin Roosevelt, and yet he, by most accounts, was a superb foreign policy leader. This Republican field, with some exceptions, I think Marco Rubio speaks powerfully with some real ideas about foreign policy. Generally, they don't have a lot of experience. We've learned watching Barack Obama learn on the job the dangers of that. And I think the American public, looking at this election, that's one thing Hillary Clinton really has going for her. I wonder if people will want to roll the dice again with a very inexperienced person. I mean, Frank Rich is right. We're not at war. But we are fighting a very dangerous terrorist adversary in ISIS, which is expanding. Congressman Nunes is right. It is becoming a global force. So that'll be a factor in 2016, and people want somebody who they have confidence is going to be a good leader in that.
You know, Frank, and you just did a piece about this in New York Magazine about the situation in Baltimore, which is not about foreign policy in the least, but it certainly seems to me to be an issue before the American people right now. And this is this sort of racial divide that we have been reminded of, for want of a better way to say it, by these recent events involving the police and African Americans.
Well, exactly. And keep in mind where the conventions are taking place in 2016. And the Republicans are in Cleveland, the Democrats are in Philadelphia. Both these cities have had police departments with African-American police chiefs investigated by the Justice Department for abuses, much in the way the Baltimore Department is now. Both these cities have enormous amount of poverty and unemployment, which is much a piece of this as race. We're going to see two conventions, I think, in a very tone-deaf way, I suspect, in both cases, partying there. And it's sort of going to dramatize, I think, a big domestic problem we have. You know, Cleveland is where the 12-year-old Tamir Rice, you know, was killed for carrying a toy gun. There have been similar cases in Philadelphia. All of this is going to be front and center in 2016. It's not going away. It's never gone away, even before recent years. And I feel, you know, it's going to be much more, short of war, I think it's going to be a much bigger deal than the Middle East.
Do you think this is something that goes beyond police relations with the black communities? Because I certainly do. I think what we are reminded of here and what we've been seeing is that African Americans can look at one set of facts and white people can look at the same set of facts and sometimes come up with entirely different conclusions. And it seems to me that's what we need to be working on and thinking about right now. And how do you bridge that gap? Frank, what?
It's very, very difficult. No one has a real solution. And we get into the stale debate about government versus private enterprise. But clear, and we talk about having a national discussion about race. I don't think that cuts it. I think the country, as the president said, is going to have to decide it really wants to address this. This is, you know, 50 years of riots in America, often for the same causes, of the same triggers. And I think there's going to have to be a real mobilization. And I hate to use this cliche, but it's going to take a leader. Imagine, for instance, if one Republican candidate, well, we have 15 to 20 Republican candidates. Imagine if one of them, doesn't even matter which one, really decided in a real way to talk to Black America, not make a cameo appearance at Howard University or turn up at one convention of the NAACP or whatever, really rolled up his or her sleeves and made some kind of interesting leadership statement about digging into this. But it's not even on the radar screen of one of our two major political parties.
Let me go back to what's been happening here in Washington. The president had this rather unusual summit with Arab leaders. And of all things, he invites six countries. These are all allies of the United States. And only two of them, David, chose to send their top guys. King Salman of Saudi Arabia sent his number two and number three. And that was pretty much the rule. What do you make of that?
Well, I think that there's no other way to look at the Saudi refusal to send King Salman after they had said that he would be coming as dissing the president. I think presidents don't make that ask without the expectation that they'll say yes. I'm told by people who attended the meetings at Camp David that they were very positive, that getting these people together, the group that came are all pretty much of the same age. They spoke informally. Sheikhs and emirs raised their hands and interrupted. And one person in the White House said to me, you know, one thing we've learned is we should have done this a long time ago, that these allies are important to us, that they've been anxious about American leadership. They needed to sit down with the president and hear the president explain what he's doing. So I think that's one takeaway. They're going to do this meeting again. Hopefully King Salman, if he's well and his health is an issue, will be at the next one. But no question the Saudis gave a kind of qualified negative message in not sending him.
I think you make a very interesting point. I mean, it's like when the president asks somebody if he wants to serve in his cabinet. They always find out beforehand. If the president calls and asks you, what will you say? And you get people chanting. In this case, they asked the king to come, and he didn't show up. It's pretty hard to, you know, get past that.
It's not something that makes the White House look impressive as an organization at the moment. It looks a little bit personal towards the president and towards U.S. policy. I think just as interesting the past few weeks as this meeting has been the trade authority drama, in which the president and the left of his party have been having some tensions, and there are plenty of Republicans who will support him, maybe enough, maybe not enough. It's been interesting to see the president be cuffed about and rebuffed publicly by some people he used to be able to rely on to obey at least politesse.
And push back. Which he did.
Yeah. Well, I want to thank all three of you for being with us this morning. There's been a lot of news this week, and it was good to kick it around with all of you. We'll be back in 1 minute. Well, that's all the time we have for today. We want to thank you for being with us, and be sure to join us next week for more Face the Nation. We'll see you then. Today's guests were Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker, Congressman Devin Nunes, former Defense Secretary Robert Gates, Senator Bob Casey, and Robert Sumwalt from the National Transportation Safety Board. The executive producer of Face the Nation is Mary Hager. The senior producers are Rob Hinden and Jill Jackson. This broadcast was directed by Sue Ann Stocky Wayne. Face the Nation originates in CBS News in Washington. For more Face the Nation, we're online at facethenation.com, and you can follow Face the Nation, Bob Schieffer, and CBS Radio News on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. Face the Nation is also rebroadcast on our digital network, CBSN, at 2 and 6 p.m. Eastern every Sunday.